Hello. Welcome to this week's edition of the Africa Climate Conversations podcast. I'm your host, Sophie Mbogo. Last week, we talked about challenges and opportunities climate change presents for the African continent. This week, we are looking into a critical issue for Africa, adaptation. As you know, flooding, droughts, landslides, cyclones are becoming intense and more frequent. So this conversation has been made possible by a collaboration with the African Development Bank Group, in particular its Climate Change and Green Growth Department. The African Development Bank Group is the continent's premier development finance institution. I'm so humbled today to host the Climate Adaptation and Green Growth Manager, Alhamdu Dosuma, and Climate and Environment Manager, Gareth Phillips, both from the African Development Bank Group. Alhamdu, if we just start with you, why is adaptation so important for the African continent? And when you talk about adaptation, what exactly are we talking about?
Great. Thank you for this opportunity. As you know, to address climate change, we have two strategies. Mm-hmm. The first one is mitigation, which enables us to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which, as you know, as a major cause of the human-induced climate change. And the second strategy is adaptation. Adaptation has a particularity that it offers an alternative solution, given that all efforts that you put in place to reduce greenhouse gas emission will still result in residual climate change. Yes. So you still need adaptation to address the residual impacts of climate change, which affects countries, communities, especially those with limited coping mechanism and capacity. Mm-hmm. And for Africa, adaptation is a priority because Africa is the host of the most of the least developed countries in the world. Mm-hmm. And evidence has already shown that the continent is the most vulnerable continent in the world, despite being the least contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. And to date, as we speak, adaptation comes with a great sense of urgency for Africa. Mm-hmm. Just a couple of months ago, as you know, extreme events, in particular flooding, have devastated East and West Africa, resulting in significant devastations. Within a month, from August to September, more than 1.2 million people in 12 different countries have been affected by flooding. Mm-hmm. Countries are still in trajectories of being affected by floods during the monsoon season, which will still continue up until November, so this month. Mm-hmm. A country like Sudan, for instance, has declared 3 months state of emergency over flooding that caused enormous damage and cost lives. This adds on what happened already 1 year ago with cyclones Idai and Kenneth, mm-hmm. which have devastated Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Malawi, mm-hmm. with a damage costed at about $2 billion, and with more than 1,000 people who died. Mm-hmm. So this shows you how urgent, important, and critical this adaptation for the world, and particularly for Africa, which is the most affected region due to the impacts of climate change.
Absolutely. Is adaptation seen as priority when it comes to international negotiations on climate change?
Unfortunately, globally, attention is more on mitigation than adaptation. Mm-hmm. Despite the urgency of the matter, adaptation is still seen as not a priority, especially in developed countries. But these things are changing, because we see that some developed countries are also considering having adaptation strategies. So as part of the global climate change negotiations under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, we have seen that adaptation is getting some level of attention now. Since Paris, the COP21 that took place in Paris in December 2015, You know, developing countries, especially least developed countries like African countries, have strongly advocated for adaptation being part of the new agreement. So it resulted in the fact that now the Paris Agreement has a global goal on adaptation, which is a good achievement as compared to the previous years. But this may also affect, you know, if we move towards, you know, implementing the Paris Agreement effectively, this will change the narrative. For instance, on finance, as you may know, as we speak today, 90% of global climate finance goes to mitigation. Only 10% is dedicated to adaptation. But we are hoping that with the global goal on adaptation, we are able to, you know, to increase the adaptation finance. You know, it is very low as compared to the needs and the priorities. And even at for disaster risk management, you know that only 12% of the funds dedicated to disaster risk management are allocated to prevention, you know, disaster prevention, compared to 88% that is allocated to emergency response. So globally, I think there is thing that the situation is not that good, but we are hoping that it has to change, because adaptation is no longer an issue of developing countries or least developed countries, but it is also an issue for developed countries. As you may remember, some cyclones are affecting directly developed countries. Like, you know, in 2003, 2005, you know that cyclones affected the United States. They are still affecting the tropical cyclones before while they affect the Caribbean, for instance, they also affect usually the United States. Europe has also been affected. You know, you remember that heat wave in 2003 that affected Western Europe. You know, it's an adaptation issue. So I observe that this narrative is changing. Adaptation is no longer a localized issue. It's not an issue for poor countries like African countries, but it is getting a lot of momentum as a global priority. As you may also know, there is a creation of the Global Center on Adaptation that took place recently, and Africa is hosting the regional office for that global center. So with those initiatives, you know, at global level, we are hoping that the narrative will change, and adaptation is no longer going to be considered as an issue of poor countries only.
Okay. I'm listening to you speak, and I'm thinking, to what extent, and maybe I just want you to explain how adaptation and development are interrelated together, especially in the case for Africa.
Yes, I think adaptation and development are interrelated, especially in Africa. And in this continent, I believe that adaptation should be considered as an integral part of the development planning of our countries, because most of our economies rely on sectors that are climate sensitive, including agriculture, natural resources, water, coastal infrastructure, etc. All of those sectors are climate sensitive, while they are the main sectors for the economy. So responding to this vulnerability requires adjustments in the economic systems in Africa. And this imperative of adaptation and resilience building have to be included into national development plans. As we said, the adaptation and development are related, and there is no way we should plan for adaptation without mainstreaming it into our development strategies. So for me, building climate resilience into all our development sectors is important. And this has to come with great opportunities as well, because I see an opportunity here when you mainstream resilience and adaptation into development planning. There is an opportunity to boost your economies with high returns, and also you ensure that you ensure economic prosperity and build resilience into your economic system. So ultimately, there is a trade-off linking adaptation with development, particularly in Africa, where the two are the two sides of the same coin.
And what are the challenges that come to that?
The fact that our planning systems, our budgeting and programming processes do not take into consideration adaptation. It's a challenge. You know, when a country adopts its budget every year, we see that in Africa, there is no provision for adaptation. There is no provision for resilience building. That's an issue. Another challenge is the limited financing. Currently, the finance that is available to adaptation is very limited in Africa. Figures have been displayed, and there is evidence that shows that the economic cost of climate vulnerability in the continent is very high. It is estimated that starting this year up to 2030, Africa will lose between 7 to 15 billion every year due to the devastating effects of climate change. So this is a challenge African countries have to address. And if there is no action, these costs will rise to 45 to 50 billion per year by 2040. And it will go up and up. So there is something that African countries have to be aware of, that inaction in terms of adaptation and building resilience is going to have a lot of impact in the development systems. And this is a challenge they have to address. And not only African countries, but also the international community. As I have said earlier, 90% of global funds on climate change goes to mitigation, and only 10% is allocated to adaptation. Yeah. This is not sufficient. But there are opportunities as well, despite the challenges. Some challenges, and let me also emphasize on some of them. In Africa, we know that adaptation is a priority.
Yeah.
We know that financing is limited, but we also observe that there are initiatives that are going on, but the challenge is the fragmentation of those initiatives. There are too many initiatives, small scale initiatives that are uncoordinated, and they come with a lot of transaction costs. So I think we need to fix that. And I believe that the creation of the Africa Office for the Global Center on Adaptation will really provide us with an opportunity to ensure a better coordination among the various adaptation initiatives across the continent. Other challenges also in Africa include the limited expertise in the countries, and also the issue relating to the barriers to the penetration of clean technologies in the continent. These are other challenges, as well as the lack of governance, the limited coordination, as I said, lack of prioritization of adaptation, as I already said. I think these are issues that are undermining the delivery of adaptation action in the continent. And at the international level, the not fulfilling of the climate finance commitment by developed countries is an issue. As you may know, developed countries have committed to deliver 100 billion per year by 2020 as climate finance to developing countries. And this commitment is not met as we speak. And this comes with challenges also to countries that are mostly affected by the climate change impacts.
Absolutely. But what opportunities exist?
Opportunity exists, of course, because investing in climate resilience is a smart economics. As adaptation investments consistently deliver high returns with benefit cost ratios ranging from 2:1 to 10:1, according to the recent report by the Global Commission on Adaptation. And adaptation action also creates jobs, and it comes with superior local benefits. So there are opportunities in investing in adaptation. Globally, we did an assessment at the African Development Bank last year, the assessment shows that climate action comes with an investment opportunity for Africa amounting to a total of $3 trillion US dollar by 2030. So this is an investment opportunity that needs to be captured by African countries, by investors, etc. To make adaptation a business. It's actually a real business. If you take a sector like energy, there is an opportunity of about 32 billion per year in investing in renewable energy by 2030. And renewable energy has a co-benefit for both mitigation and adaptation. In the agriculture sector, for instance, there is an opportunity for climate smart agriculture. And climate smart agriculture comes with opportunity to increase agricultural output and also to enable Africa to feed itself and create jobs. In the cities, for instance, urban development is an opportunity if we invest in smart cities. As you know, cities are growing faster than ever in the developing world, especially in Africa. And the infrastructure investment that are made in cities in the next few years need to be both low carbon intensive and climate resilient. So you need to take that opportunity to invest in those cities that will provide the opportunity to reduce vulnerability, to improve air quality and public health, as well as reducing poverty and enhancing safety. So investing in smart cities for us is an opportunity to both build your economies and also address vulnerability. Another sector that I see as important is natural capital, natural resources. Investing in our natural capital in a very sustainable way will come with opportunities also for green growth, because natural capital accounts for between 30 to 50% of total wealth in Africa. But we see that this capital, this natural capital, is being used unsustainably, and some of it is being illegally traded. So we believe that there is an opportunity if we implement widely and smartly green growth activities, we'll be able to address these challenges and build sustainability into our natural capital.
And just to remind you, this is the Green Economy series, and today we are talking about adaptation and why it's critical for the continent. This conversation is made possible by a collaboration between the Africa Climate Conversations and the African Development Bank Group, and in particular, its Climate Change and Green Growth Department. AFDB is the continent's premier development finance institution. And talking of investment, Gareth, financing adaptation is critical if the continent is to achieve the opportunities Alhamdu has just outlined. The African Development Bank has been advocating for the adaptation benefit mechanism. What is this mechanism all about?
Yes, well, thank you very much for asking me about that. Maybe before I jump into the adaptation benefits mechanism, I can give a little bit of background about the reason why we need support for adaptation finance and why governments around the world have been slow to provide that and why the private sector isn't engaged. So the reason why adaptation and resilience is so important is that if we don't help people become resilient to climate change, and here we talk about households and communities and economies, if we don't make them resilient to climate change, then what happens is that disasters come and they push people backwards into poverty. And we're seeing that even now at full speed or at accelerated speed with COVID-19. Yeah. People are pushed back into poverty. And when they fall back into poverty, they have no choice but to consume the natural capital that surrounds them. So that means that they fall back to doing practices which are not sustainable, that are destructive. And we see that in Africa, where we have 600 million farmers who rely on rain-fed agriculture, who rely on collecting fuel wood for biomass and who farm in unsustainable manners. And all of these things contribute to greenhouse gas emissions. And that is why Africa's major source of greenhouse gas emissions comes from the land use and forestry sector. It's because those people are pushed into situations where they have no choice but to use the resources that are around them, and they're having a negative impact. So resilience is really important. And if we don't address resilience, then we won't be able to achieve the zero emissions target of the Paris Agreement. So now when we then look at what governments have done to support finance, climate finance, we divide this up into mitigation finance and adaptation finance. Yeah. Mitigation finance has done very well. And in fact, there are a lot of policies and strategies and initiatives around that have created a sustainable source of finance to support investment into mitigation and to help create business models that support mitigation. So sort of the most obvious things we see are things like energy tariffs that reflect the cost of generation. And so if renewable energy is slightly more expensive, that's reflected in the tariff that's charged, although in fact in many places renewable energy is becoming cheaper. We see things like emission trading schemes and carbon taxes that are now quite common in developed countries, and in, for example, in South Africa, they're proposing a carbon tax. Then there's a number of voluntary initiatives. One that's been running for a long time is the Swiss Klimascent, where the Swiss government put a cent on the purchase of a litre of gasoline and diesel, and they used that money to purchase emission reductions from mitigation projects. So there's lots of examples of good mitigation projects and sustainable sources of finance to channel into those projects. But when we look at adaptation, the level of understanding and the level of finance for adaptation is much less. There are only a couple of examples of finance for adaptation that I can think of. And one, there was this initiative called the Clean Development Mechanism that was developed under the Kyoto Protocol. And there was a share of proceeds, so 2% of the revenues from the CDM went to supporting adaptation. In fact, it was used to capitalize the adaptation fund. So that was one source of finance. And there's another source, which is the Green Climate Fund, where 50% of their investment is supposed to be channeled to adaptation. But otherwise, there is very little awareness of the need to support adaptation. And really what needs to happen is that governments in developed world and consumers in the developed world or in wealthy countries need to recognize that they have to contribute towards the costs associated with adapting to the impacts that are caused by the greenhouse gas emissions released by the goods and services that we buy. So the mitigation component is the second part of that sentence. It's, you know, we're doing relatively well in dealing with the emissions from the goods and services, but we're not doing very well with the first part of that sentence, addressing the costs associated with the impacts that come from those greenhouse gas emissions. So we really need governments and consumers to come up with sustainable sources of finance to support adaptation. And if we can create that kind of supply of investment, then we could move on to looking at business models that can support investment into adaptation. And that's where the adaptation benefits mechanism comes into play.
Explain a little bit what it is all about and how it came about.
Well, it came about from actually some work that we did to look at other uses for the Clean Development Mechanism. The Clean Development Mechanism was, you know, it was an early and in many ways a very successful program to promote investment into mitigation. And what happened back in the 1990s, we knew that, for example, renewable energy was a good idea, and we knew that it produced electricity with this co-benefit of zero emissions. But renewable energy was more expensive than fossil fuel, and renewable energy producers couldn't really compete. So we came up with mechanisms that allowed us to pay project developers for delivering emission reductions. And so if you were a renewable energy producer in the early 2000s, you could produce renewable energy and these things called certified emission reductions, and you had two cash flows. And that additional cash flow revolutionized investment into renewable energy. And that's what's really resulted in the uptake that we see of renewable energy now. The prices have come down, and in many places it's now highly competitive with fossil fuels. So we looked at the Clean Development Mechanism. We said, can't we do the same thing for adaptation? Because adaptation projects also deliver co-benefits in the way of making people more resilient to climate change. But the developers don't get any recognition for that. They don't get paid for it. So the adaptation benefit mechanism tries to create a business model whereby we can pay project developers for delivering certified adaptation benefits. And that additional cash flow should be set at such a rate that it overcomes the barriers to investment in adaptation projects. And we think that if we can do that, then actually we could stimulate a lot of private sector investment into the adaptation space.
Who can invest in it? Is it the donors or individual countries?
So we think that donors and ultimately consumers, so consumers in wealthy countries really should be contributing towards the cost of adaptation. So, you know, my family lives in the UK and, you know, really when they buy goods and services, they should be making a contribution towards paying for the costs of the impacts associated with those goods and services. It's an extension of the polluter pays principle. I mean, there's no reason why we shouldn't do that. So, for example, you could manage this through a very small percentage on VAT, a value-added tax, or a financial transaction tax, or a levy on the purchase of fossil fuels or energy. And that money would then be channeled into the purchase of the adaptation benefits. Now, what happens is, what we're proposing is that we create a new financial instrument, and we call it an adaptation benefits offtake agreement, which is just like a power purchase agreement. It's an agreement that the project developer signs with a creditworthy offtaker. And it says, when you deliver an adaptation benefit, we'll pay you this much money. And if you can get an agreement like that with a creditworthy offtaker, like a fund or a donor, then you can go to a local commercial bank to raise capital. You can go to equity investors. You can go to business partners, and you can bring all kinds of capital. So you can bring financial capital in the form of equity and debt, but you can also bring entrepreneurial skills. You can bring what we call sweat equity, where, you know, partners come and work together to make the project work. You can bring contributions in kind, like labor and land resources and so on, to make those things work. Because you know that if you can produce the adaptation benefit, you're going to get paid. And then with that payment, everybody gets they get paid out. They get a return from their investment. So what we want is we want to use this adaptation levy or the funds from developed country consumers to sign the offtake agreements, which will then stimulate private sector investment. And when I say private sector investment, I mean local, micro, small and medium enterprises in African countries. Not-for-profit organizations, NGOs and so on, they can all come to do these kinds of projects on a small scale and context-specific basis. So you could have community-based organizations saying, we need support to develop a goat farming program or to look at poultry rearing, but we need some cash to invest into that. And this mechanism could provide that kind of investment, and then the local communities can bring their capital into play. And so we mobilize both finance from developed countries, from donors and from consumers, and we use that to leverage additional investment from local private sector enterprises working in the African context. And all of that finance that we mobilize gets added up and can be reported under Article 13 of the Paris Agreement as contributions towards the global adaptation goal, and also particularly and specifically towards this target of mobilizing $50 billion for adaptation. That came from Copenhagen, this target of $100 billion, 50% of which was for adaptation and 50% for mitigation. So this program would enable developed countries to report their contributions to that target and to report their contributions to the global adaptation goal under the Paris Agreement.
I'm listening to you and I'm thinking of just giving you an example and seeing whether I really do understand, and so that the listener out there could actually understand what we are talking about. So, for example, let's say an organization, a CBO or a civil society organization or just a private sector decides, well, lives in Mali and there's a community in a rural area that mainly they are pastoralist. And then so what they want to build resilience for this particular community is by reviving the traditional grazing mechanism. And so such a project would fall under this adaptation benefit mechanism. They would be able to get funding from such a project?
Yes. So if we take that example of transitioning back to traditional grazing, so I'm assuming, and here we will have to assume a certain scenario, but I assume that the barriers to doing that are, there may be several barriers. There may be some people that need to be moved off land where they, you know, where they've settled. There might be a need to negotiate some sort of settlements. Some people might need to be compensated. and maybe the farmers need some financial support for a period of several years until such time as the grazing mechanism is re-established and is working again. So we have a range of activities that need to be done, and there's some costs associated with that.
Yeah.
So what we would propose is that those activities would be detailed in an activity design document. And we, as part of that activity design document, we would say, okay, the adaptation benefits that we're going to deliver are going to be steps towards the successful reintegration and re-establishment of a traditional grazing mechanism. Mm-hmm. And we might say, okay, there's four milestones over a period of 4 years each year, and you have to achieve each of those milestones. Mm-hmm. And when those milestones have been achieved, then we would pay an agreed price. Now, the thing is, what is the agreed price? We don't know what the agreed price is. So we need to see a project document and a cash flow laid out that says, these are the costs. And this is where we need support. And if we can achieve milestone one, then we need a payment of this much. And if we can achieve milestone two, we need a payment of this much. And then when we get to milestone four, we expect the traditional grazing now to be re-established and to be sustainable. And at that point, the project needs no further financial support. So we would then take this project and this concept, and we would put into what we call our adaptation supermarket. Where we are advertising a range of adaptation projects, and we would then want donors and consumers and philanthropists and funds to come and sign the adaptation agreements to purchase those adaptation benefits. And then when they sign that agreement, then the project can go ahead and start working. Now, if the project is successful and they deliver on their milestones, then they'll get the financial payments. Mm-hmm. If the project is not successful and they don't deliver, then the donor, the off-taker, isn't going to pay. And so the project developers and the communities, community-based organization, they need to be very confident that they're going to be able to deliver this, and they need to work hard to make sure that they achieve the objectives. And we will see, as we start to do some of these projects, we'll start to get information as to what the costs are. At the moment, we've no idea what the costs might be. So the first two or three projects we do, we'll be feeling it in the dark. But once we've done some of these projects and we've had the data verified, then we will get better information on what it costs to help pastoralists transition back to community-based or traditional farming techniques, and we'll have more information about that, and we'll be able to ensure better value for money for the donors and for the off-takers. So that's a really nice example of how this approach could work, and there are many other examples of where we have the need to create adaptation benefits, but there are financial barriers that are bigger and smaller, and that we need a financial contribution to overcome that. Mm-hmm. Paid against deliverable outcomes.
Okay, so two things that I would want us to address. The issue of writing bankable proposals, because it has been a whole issue in terms in Africa, mainly that has been blamed when it comes to access in different climate finance mechanism. And another thing that I would also want you to address is the issue of risk, because investing in climate adaptation in the continent is considered a very high risk when it comes to investment. How do you, this mechanism, address the issue of risk and also address the issue of writing bankable proposals within Africa?
Yes, two very good questions. Let me start with the bankable proposals, first of all. So I'm fully with you. The Clean Development Mechanism became terribly complicated. And the level of expertise required to prepare the project proposals was extremely demanding. There was a reason for that, and that reason was that the projects were generating these fungible emission reduction units, mm-hmm. that were tradable and that were being used for legal compliance in an international protocol. And there was liability associated with those issues. They had to be extremely accurate because people were paying money and could be penalized and prosecuted if they failed to achieve their targets. So the CDM became terribly complicated. And needed typically northern expertise, European experts to come and do the work, and it didn't really take off in Africa. Now, the adaptation benefit mechanism is a little bit different because we are generating what we are calling certified adaptation benefits. These certified adaptation benefits are not tradable and transferable. A certified adaptation benefit is a packet of information that the ultimate off-taker, the consumer of that information, uses to make a report under the Paris Agreement. So there is no specific target that they have to meet. It's effectively a voluntary process of reporting information about activities that the host country and the off-taker agree are contributing towards adaptation needs. So the most important thing really is that the host country says, yes, this project contributes to our adaptation needs. And if you can deliver these adaptation benefits, then we'll be very pleased to report them as contributions towards our adaptation needs. Okay. So in that sense, it's a voluntary project. It's simple commercial liability. And, you know, that means that if you as the off-taker disagree with what your project is producing, you just go to commercial arbitration, you sort it out between yourselves. It's not an international issue. And also the methodologies. We specifically want the methodologies to be simpler and to identify simple outputs that we can use to verify that we have a high level of confidence will result in outcomes and impacts. So, for example, if you look at your example of the traditional grazing, we might be able to pick up the return to traditional grazing from satellite imagery. Because we would see the change in the vegetation, probably, and that could be picked up. So it would be that makes it much easier to do, much cheaper to do. It can be verified remotely, and we can say, you know, if we can see that there's a 30% ground cover or an increase in ground cover from woody species, and there's diversity in species, then we consider that a milestone has been met. Mm-hmm. So we look for much simpler ways of verifying this information, and that makes the whole project simpler and cheaper. So that deals with sort of the complexity of the thing. We expect it to be able to be, you know, developed by, okay, you'll still need consultants, but they can be local consultants. They don't have to be sort of European consultants coming in at such high cost. Mm-hmm. And on the risk side of it, there's a number of ways that we can address this risk. I mean, for sure, you know, we know adaptation carries a range of risks. And I think that as we do early projects, for sure, we'll find some failures and we can learn from those and make corrections. But we can also provide an insurance process or a guarantee for the off-takers. And we've spoken already with the Green Climate Fund about this, and they indicated that they would be interested in providing a guarantee for the lenders who lend money to these projects. So if you take, for example, a local commercial bank and they agree to lend an adaptation project $2 million, and they expect that $2 million to be paid back through the delivery and payment for the adaptation benefits. Now, if the project doesn't work and those adaptation benefits don't get delivered, then the commercial bank has lost out. So the GCF said that they would be interested in providing a guarantee facility that could pay that $2 million back to the local commercial bank if the project fails. Okay. So, you know, that kind of a guarantee instrument can provide real support to developing these kinds of activities and take away quite a lot of the risk associated with it. And then finally, the point that I made about it being the local micro, medium, and small enterprises, micro, small, and medium enterprises that are investing. Those are people who live with these risks on a day-to-day basis. They're already bought into those risks. Yeah. So, you know, it doesn't really matter to them. I mean, you know, they live in a country where there's a political risk. Well, so what? I mean, that's just life. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, they live with that on a day-to-day basis. Whereas obviously external investors coming in may say, oh no, that country's too risky. But that's why, you know, we think that this ability to do the small scale context specific adaptation projects is so important.
Absolutely. Gareth and Alhamdu, thank you so much for joining me today. Unfortunately, that's all the time we had. And I appreciate you both taking time for this conversation.
That's great. Well, thank you very much indeed. It's been a real pleasure. If your listeners want to learn a little bit more about it, you can just Google AFDB, Adaptation Benefit Mechanism, and you'll find our website very easily. And there's lots of information there about the work that we're doing and our plans for moving forward. And we're still hopeful that we're going to be able to raise some finance to do some work prior to COP26 in Glasgow next year, where we hope to be able to have some side events and present our results and so on, and try to get some more buy-in from some of the major donor countries. So thank you very much indeed for your time.
That was Gareth Phillips and Alhamdu Dosuma, both from the African Development Bank Group, talking about adaptation, why it's critical for the continent, and adaptation benefit mechanism championed by the African Development Bank. My sincere gratitude to the African Development Bank Group, in particular its Climate Change and Green Growth Department, whose collaboration with the African Climate Conversations has made this conversation possible. AFDB is the continent's premier development finance institution. Remember, this podcast is available on our website, Africa Climate Conversations, Google, Apple Podcasts, and every other channel you access your podcasts from. Please do not forget to share this podcast. Remember, someone on your network would really, really benefit from this information. But do you have a question or a topic you'd want us to discuss? Well, kindly feel free to email me using info@africaclimateconversations.com. Until next week, have a productive and safe week ahead.